Our Dharma talk today will be given by Bounda Swe, priest and Dharma teacher, Ed Oberholzer.
So, and I want you to hold on to that "so," because there's going to be a test about it at the end of the talk. We were given, or we were asked, to speak about a favorite koan or a koan that is meaningful to us. And the first thing that struck me is that this is a wonderful opportunity for me to practice my dualistic nature and divide them up into favorite and meaningful. So let's begin with favorite. And to get into that, I have to go back 40 years. Ken Rivard, someone some of you may know, and I were roommates and used to spend a very happy Sunday afternoon watching Edward O. Reischauer introducing classical Japanese movies. You know, The Seven Samurai, Yojimbo, Throne of Blood. It was one of those things that gave me this overly romantic view of what it meant to, I guess, be a Japanophile. And for whatever harm that may have done to me, it did, thank God, lead me many years down the road to Zen, thinking again that coming to Zen, I would learn how to be like Toshiro Mifune. I could walk down that path, throw the stick in the air, and simply go where it pointed. And there are koans that I bring that sort of romantic view of Zen too. The first one that comes to mind, of course, is, each of us has our own, but mine is Nanchuan having this wonderful, wonderful dialogue with a very young Zhao Zhou, and letting him know that ordinary mind is the way. It's a great koan, but it's not one I'm going to talk about. Because there's that other set of koans, that set of meaningful ones. And for me, that means the koans I hate. The koans that drive me nuts. The koans that poke a finger at, you know, wounds and bruises, and they're the hard ones. They're the ones that well, Hakuin had what, his own set of, was it like 8 Nanto koans, the koans that are hard to pass, and of course they were koans that were hard for him to pass. We all have those. You know, some of us were able to get to those Nanto koans of Hakuin's and go, oh, simple, and breeze through them. And yet, the very next one that we would come to, we would sit and agonize over for months and months and months. It's because they find you where you actually live. And the koan curriculum is so vast that it's filled with all of these wonderful little pointers that prod us and drive us mad. I have a large number of those, actually. And imagine my surprise when Sunday evening Josh Bartok chose exactly one of them. Fortunately, there are many more. And who knows? Maybe during the Sangha I'll be able to get to them all. But I was really lucky. Because 2 years ago, at the Ango, I was given a koan at my Shuso Hosin ceremony by these two. A koan that that I wasn't expecting, and yet when I read it, I should have been. It's a koan I'm going to talk to you about today. It's a koan that gets me exactly where I live. It's a koan that I don't even have to think about because it comes up day in and day out. It came up at the beginning of this talk. It came up when Steve bowed to me as I sat in Zazen, and I felt compelled to return that bow. So, what is this wonderful, nasty little koan for me? It's case 37 from the Wumakan. And it goes, a monk asked Zhao Zhou, what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West? Zhao Zhou said, the oak tree in the courtyard. Now, I often don't have a particularly subtle mind when it comes to dealing with koans. And I was really lucky because Wuman presented us with a verse that acted in a way as a bludgeon for me, because it made it very clear where this koan hit me. And his verse goes, words do not convey the fact. Language is not an expedient. Attached to words, your life is lost. Blocked by phrases, you are bewildered. That's a pointer for me. For how to live a life mindfully and with right speech. And I think especially with right speech. My first intimation, right, the first thing that comes to me is that God, I talk too much. You know, if you mentioned this to my wife, she would look at you in utter bewilderment, because I'm often told that I don't talk enough. That you know, communication would be a really good thing, and that she would really like it if we would just sit down and have a conversation each evening. Something more than, how are you? Fine. So that's not really what this points to. It's not that I talk too much, although there's a little bit of that in certain circumstances. It's that, and again, my wife is a much subtler person than I am. She would go, No, Ed. It's not that you don't talk enough. It's that you don't communicate. And I think that gets to the verse here. It's not a matter of saying too much. It's a matter of saying just enough. It's a matter of being present and saying what is needed. We heard that last night with that wonderful story of Master Ma and the Go ask someone else, I'm tired. Just what was needed, not some long explanation, not some attempt at making somebody feel better. It's just what arose right there in the moment. Avalokiteshvara did the same thing with the 80,000 arms and 80,000 eyes and how that's like reaching behind you in the night for the pillow. It's just doing what arises right then. That's right speech. Saying what is necessary. It's doing what is necessary. The extra bow that truly was not needed, because when you sit in zazen, you are bowing to the universe. It was that little extra thing that brings this koan back to my to my daily life. It's what makes it prod that bruise, that little wound somewhere or another that needs to be prodded in order ultimately to make it better. I like to think in terms of Oryoki, you know, the practice we have during Seishin of eating a meal with mindfulness and with the knowledge that the word Oryoki means just enough. And for me, that's what speech should be. It should be just enough. Not more, not less. Sometimes that means blathering on. Sometimes that means saying much more than I would like to say. This is one of those moments, frankly. But it's one of those things that's necessary, and when I go back to my normal glum that was silence, know that it's not really glum, that it's just doing what is necessary. Thank you.
So I invite you to sit comfortably. We'll have our Dharma dialogue now, and this is a chance to ask questions about the talk or about practice as you're encountering it.
Oh, and the test, by the way, is, so what was the word so? Was it necessary? I do it all the time.
So?
Yeah, right.
At least one person passed.
As usual. Well, out of context, is it S-E-W or S-O-W? S-O? I couldn't... I mean,
well, so, you know,
so, once again, you know, the simplicity and the ordinariness of the response to the case, you know, every koan just seems to be bringing this up for us, you know, so the oak tree in the garden, you know, what could be more simple and alive and, you know, present than that? And every single case that we've looked at, you know, the pillow and the water bowl and the tea bowl and all these things that are just, you know, we call them the great miracles versus the lesser miracles, the chopping wood, carrying water. You know, how lovely that you should bring this to us as another gift of these talks, and I'm grateful for being reminded of and seeing that oak tree. Thank you.
When I first got that koan years and years and years ago, I remember thinking, oh, I know how to do this one. You know, there was kind of like, there was sort of like a pattern, and so I went in and I did it, and then I walked away and I got to other koans and got screwed up. It wasn't really until 2 years ago that koan came back to me, mm-hmm. and the richness of the oak tree in the courtyard, how that could reach out and hit me, mm-hmm. didn't happen until then, and it was years later. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I really have to thank you both.
You know that koan is considered one of the most important koans, like Mu. It's because it points directly to the great matter in the way that Mu does, or the single hand. There's a handful of those koans, and people do, you know, just sometimes breeze through them, but then there are checking questions on that one that people don't breeze through often, and that's always interesting. Everybody's different. I loved that you pointed that out, that we have our own nanto means difficult to pass koans. And it's always funny when you find out what they are from this great Japanese Zen master, Hakuin, who had his own nanto koans. Jeez, I don't know what he was talking about. He was some great master, and he got stuck with this one. But then, I love the way you describe it. Yeah. And, you know, just koans are funny, because not everybody works with koans in our practice. But all the practices are that way. If you're doing breath practice, you might think, got it, you know, check. And then it unfolds and it becomes vast and deep and wide, and it's suddenly you don't know how to do it anymore. Or Shikantaza is really like that, just sitting practice. Everybody, I like to sometimes ask people who are doing Shikantaza, so what are you doing? And I have never received the same answer twice. But people are often very sure. You know, I got this. And then this whole practice is really about the value of not knowing, of being awake to wonder. And I think you pointed us in that direction, and I think it's important that we remember that. It's not about being sure, but not knowing, about being open.
Thank you, Ed. And I appreciate the you bringing up the weight of a word or words. That's never hit me so hard until I started working with koans and appreciating how we carry this weight with any particular word or particular phrase, and we get stuck on a word that, you know, either drives us down or cuts through. Mm-hmm. It's just a word, but we bring so much to it. Just words, you know. Mm-hmm.
Right, and it changes with, you know, you come back a year from now,
yeah.
2 years from now, and it's amazing how it'll be the other word, or maybe it'll be the same one. Who knows?
And I think the koan curriculum and the koans are so wonderful. And I think Zen is so wonderful.
Do you?
Now that I think about it,
I think you've made a good
choice. Yeah, no. But in using words to move through words, mm-hmm. so you allude a little bit how we can talk and not say much. Mm-hmm. And I think the koans are so lovely in terms of so. How do we use these words, hear these words, in a way that moves us to some aliveness, not to more thinking, not to more great theories? So it's a very interesting tool. These koans are these teaching stories. And like this one, what was the meaning of why did Bodhidharma come from the West? And the answer, the oak tree in the garden?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me? are you trying to mess with my head? And that's, we mentioned that a little bit in the koan last night, and it's certainly sometimes my response to these koans as I read them, I get kind of irritated. Mm. I think, are you trying to mess with my head? Like, what is this, some Zen crap? You know? And the encouragement to hear these answers, like, what if that is actually the presentation of someone who has devoted his life to the practice of love and aliveness? And what if this is his very best attempt? What if he's handing it to us as clearly and open-heartedly as possible? Mm-hmm. Oak tree in the garden? What if that's it? You know, and then we start looking in this other way and we get caught by the words and our mind wraps around and wraps us around. And then this teaching is that if we stay with it, something reveals itself. It's not like we get our hacksaw out and hack through the koan and get the analytic tools and the forceps and I'll pull this out and pull that out. But something much more delightful and mysterious and unknowable happens as we encounter these. So.
You know, that raises something that hit me last night. And thank you for saying that about reading them. I'm a librarian. And for me, there is nothing more sacred than reading. And yet, when you read these texts, sometimes there are words on a page. When you hear someone recite them, when you hear someone tell them, when you hear someone's, you see someone's heart laid out as they tell that story, and you can really connect then, it's one of those things that drives me nuts because, you know, I'll sit there and I'll hear a teacher tell a koan and as they tell it, I go, ah! And then I go and I read it to memorize it so that I can bring it into Dogsan, and I sit there and go, I've lost it. Where did it go?
Yeah.
You know, that beating heart, yeah. It gets lost, but it's in that oral tradition. It's in that presentation of it.
Yeah. Exactly. So I like what you said, David, about maybe this is the simplest, most direct answer. But it also often strikes me about how that generally koans are not just simple explanations of, you know, the matter. I'm often struck with, you know, so the answer here does sound like some kind of Zen nonsense. When I initially hear probably most koans, my initial reaction is, oh, come on, dude. This is not the simplest way to answer this question. I'm quite sure it's not. Explaining what was, you know, why did Bodhidharma come?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there probably was a reason. You don't know what it is. You don't have to say the oak tree in the garden. And yet, there's something special about these stories that do set up kind of this barrier of which often arises for me around koans. You know, it kind of like stops my normal process of trying to analyze what's going on, because it clearly is not subject to my normal set of analytical tools. You know, there's no way that I'm going to figure out what is the logic behind saying oak tree in the garden when we're asking a question about Bodhidharma coming from the West. It just isn't going to work, and I have learned that. So I've kind of dropped that that idea that I'm going to be able to solve it in quite that way, and to be open to them in a different way. Because it's kind of funny, the language kind of traps us in a way. You know, we see the world through our stories and our ideas about things, and we say, oh, I'm this way and they're that way, and we have these very fixed ideas about things, and there's something about using words, you know, to cut through those fixed ideas somehow, and it's quite a thing, you know, to kind of step outside the normal logical functioning somehow, and then suddenly it just, you know, comes around and hits me on the back of the head. Boom! It's oak tree in the garden, of course.
Thanks.
This koan is very dear to my heart for a number of reasons. It was the first koan that my teacher gave me to test me when he suspected I had an awakening experience. And it was like, but it sort of totally went past any logic. I just knew what it meant for the first time in my Zen career. I knew what it meant. When Josh and I were both students, I remember at one session coming out of this is Josh Bartok, one of the other teachers in Boundless Sway, coming out of the bathroom in this corridor in this building we only used once. We rented it once for a session, very odd building, in this narrow corridor, and he was coming the other direction, and we sort of met, and we had to, you know, we were supposed to not be making eye contact and not talking as we do a retreat, and he just grabbed my shoulders and he said, "How many Zen students does it take to change a light bulb?" And I was like, "Oh, what?" And it's like that example of the brain just sputters, and I said, "I don't know." And he said, "The oak tree in the garden." And then we just laughed. He went to the bathroom. Great moment. Thank you for reminding me. I'd forgotten it. Thank you very much. Great moment in Zen.
I think after yesterday I would have said, "I have a headache."
you're getting the pattern.
I just want to say I was counting it and you used exactly the right number of
words. How many was it?
Just enough.
I was reminded of a story when you were talking about, you know, like the concern of saying too much popped into my head. It comes up in preaching. John Coltrane was in Miles Davis's quintet back in the day, and he was driving Miles Davis crazy because his solos were like 35 minutes long. Of course, when he had his own career, his solos were 60 minutes long. But anyways, he was talking with Miles, and he was like, "Yeah, man, you gotta like turn it down a little bit there." And he's just like, "You know, there's just so many ways to get at it, and there's so many pieces, and there's always another, you know, little way to flip it around and look at it. I just don't know how to end." And Miles said, "Try taking the horn out of your mouth."
So, take the horn out. So just sit for a few more breaths and then go on with our morning practice.